It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Day one of the hearings. We saw the faces. We heard the stories of Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn and Sergeant Aguino Ganell. We also heard the stories of Metro D.C. Police Officers Michael Finone and Daniel Hodges. And they were exactly what we were expecting. Horrific. They were exactly what I was expecting to come out of it. Stories of homegrown terror, of terrorists with a sense of entitlement, pumped up and pushed at these police officers while simultaneously wearing the colors of Back the Blue and waving the American flag. Really just a disgraceful day that should never be forgotten in our country's history, January 6th. And I'm glad these officers got to tell their stories. I'm hoping people listened. I really am. I'm hoping that they felt the kind of anger and the kind of, I don't really even have the word for it, for the people who perpetrated this, for those criminals, those terrorists on that day. I can't help think of what those cops felt on that day. Because understand, they started the day thinking, yeah, this is the Trump crowd. These are the people who, they're our people. They're the people who say how much they love us, how much they embrace us, only to have them turn on you like that. There are a couple of clips that caught my attention. One of them, extremely powerful, is that of D.C. Metro Police Officer Michael Finone, and I want to play that clip. Here's Michael Finone.
During the assault, I thought about using my firearm on my attackers, but I knew that if I did, I would be quickly overwhelmed. And that, in their minds, would provide them with the justification for killing me. So I instead decided to appeal to any humanity they might have. I said as loud as I could manage, "I've got kids." Thankfully, some in the crowd stepped in and assisted me. Those few individuals protected me from a crowd and inched me toward the Capitol until my fellow officers could rescue me. I was carried back inside. What happened afterwards is much less vivid. I had been beaten unconscious and remained so for more than 4 minutes. I know that Jimmy helped to evacuate me from the building and drove me to MedStar Washington Hospital Center, despite suffering significant injuries himself. At the hospital, doctors told me that I had suffered a heart attack, and I was later diagnosed with a concussion, a traumatic brain injury, and post-traumatic stress disorder. As my physical injuries gradually subsided and the adrenaline that had stayed with me for weeks waned, I've been left with the psychological trauma and the emotional anxiety of having survived such a horrific event. And my children continue to deal with the trauma of nearly losing their dad that day. What makes the struggle harder and more painful is to know so many of my fellow citizens, including so many of the people I put my life at risk to defend, are downplaying or outright denying what happened. I feel like I went to hell and back to protect them and the people in this room. But too many are now telling me that hell doesn't exist, or that hell actually wasn't that bad. The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful.
Disgraceful. I can think of a lot more harsh words. But remember, the people who did this, just tourists, just like any other day. And as he pointed out, the people who have downplayed this, it was like any other day. It was just tourists. They stayed between the ropes. Except when they were crushing this guy between, when they were tasing him 11 times or more in the base of his skull, while they were crushing the other police officer, while they were calling racial names to the others. And what's interesting, you can't find a single Republican. You can't find a single Republican who said that they watched the hearings outside of the ones that were on the panel. They were too busy. They were too busy having meetings. They were too busy. I love McConnell's thing, you know, doing the hard work of the American people. You're too busy hiding in the closet with their corporate donors or hiding from anyone to hold them accountable, unless they were having their sideshows. One Republican who everyone is calling, you know, kind of a hero. And look, I don't give people the hero title easily. I don't think Adam Kinzinger is a hero. I think he's doing his job. Good on him. This is what we should expect from statesmen. This is what we should expect from our elected leaders. But Representative Kinzinger, you know, and I guess for me, kind of the emotion that went into it. Here's Representative Kinzinger's emotional discussion.
Expected today to be quite as emotional for me as it has been. I've talked to a number of you and gotten to know you. I think it's important to tell you right now, though. You guys may, like, individually feel a little broken. You guys all talk about the effects you have to deal with, and, you know, you talk about the impact of that day. But you guys won. You guys held. You know, democracies are not defined by our bad days. We're defined by how we come back from bad days, how we take accountability for that. And for all the overheated rhetoric surrounding this committee, our mission is very simple. It's to find the truth, and it's to ensure accountability. I never expected a day to be...
Accountability. I mean, and that's the part that I find interesting about all this. Somebody has to be held accountable. Not the folks who are out on the Capitol lawn pointing fingers somewhere else. Again, today for the Republican Party as a whole, outside of Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, was all about blaming Nancy Pelosi. That was the thing. Everyone was, Nancy Pelosi, she was the Speaker of the House. Yet never said anything about Mitch McConnell, who was the majority leader. Nothing. Nothing about the, because understand, the Capitol Police are overseen by both parties. This was going to be an interesting argument. And look, Nancy Pelosi is the target of the right and always has been. And I'm not sure if it's just the misogyny or the hatred of Democrats or both. But that's where they've gone. Now, Republicans had a little shindig. They, again, as I said, pointed out that their belief, it was all Nancy Pelosi's fault, wasn't the former guy's fault. No, wasn't that at all. It was solely Nancy Pelosi's fault, all of this. That's their argument right now. So the stories you heard today of the four police officers being crushed, being tased, being beaten, all of those things. Forget that. That's what the right wants you to believe. That's what, you know, I listened to right-wing talk radio today. They weren't even really paying attention to it because it's all Nancy Pelosi. You have Elise Stefanik, the representative from New York. Elise thought it was a great opportunity today to, one, blame Nancy Pelosi, because that's what she had to say. But more importantly, she thought today would be a good day to raise money. So in her tweet, she says, "Help us fire the authoritarian Nancy Pelosi. One team, save America. donate to our effort to take back the house. And then, of course, a link for money. So while we're listening to testimony of these four heroes being crushed and beaten and tased and you know, probably broken for life now, you know, worse than when the one guy said, worse than when he was in Iraq. Elise Stefanik and the Republicans are raising money. And it's one of these things where I can't imagine, and I go back to what I said earlier, I can't imagine what the people that protected these representatives, the people like these four officers who put their lives on the line to protect these representatives. And they did. Because I believe on that day, had that mob gotten a hold of anyone in Congress, anyone, even the beloved Republicans, they probably would have killed somebody. They were out for blood. They had been ramped up. They had been geared up. They had been riled up. They had been pointed in the direction, and they had been told that that's their right. It's their house. It's their ability. They run things, and everyone is answerable to the mob. They had the gallows built. They were screaming about how they're gonna hang Mike Pence and others. These are, in the word, terrorists. And Officer Hodges used that word and defined that word because that's what those people were. They were terrorists. And the thing that gets me is I understand anger. I understand the difficulties that people have. And Donald Trump was able to do something back in 2015 and 2016, and I was commentating on this back when it was going on, that he has touched a nerve, he's hit the pulse of the working class of this country, an angry working class that have diminished opportunities, that the life that they were told was their birthright, that they were going to do better than their parents. They were going to live the American dream. They were going to 40 years in a gold watch and a solid retirement, and they were going to have dignity and respect and all of these things, only to, for many, not. And one of the things that I've been saying for a long time is, if you want to continue to see the kind of mass mob mobilization that someone like Trump can do, continue to have the massive economic inequality that we have, the massive economic insecurity we have, the massive poverty that we have in the working class across this country. Continue to have that, because that's what's going to continue to create these mobs of people who feel entitled. Because look, every one of those white faces out there, and they were pretty clear, the testimony today is that there was a couple of Asian guys, maybe a couple of women here or there, but mostly angry white guys. Until we have that portion of the American dream that I grew up believing possible, we're going to continue to have these moments. Economic opportunity is a national security issue, and we saw it on display. But beyond that, and this is where the frustration comes, the faces that we saw there, the ones who were well-organized, the white supremacists, the white nationalists, for them it wasn't about economic opportunity. It wasn't for the economic insecurity. It's the rest of the people who were in that crowd with them. And I'm hoping this is a moment where having this hearing these officers, we can maybe reach some of those people. Look, the white nationalists and the American Nazi Party, we're not going to reach them. They're fives. You leave them alone. But the people who heard that Trump message that he's going to rebuild that 50s economy of good, strong union jobs and families being able to live on one income and those things that our grandparents built, I hope this reaches them We're never getting the extreme. They saw this as an opportunity to tear everything down and to control things for themselves and, well, attack the future of this country. And my problem with this is you have a political party in this country, sans two. And I think it showed yesterday with the vote. It's showed again today where you have the Republicans pulling out of another committee, a key select committee. That it's not for them about the economy. It's not for making people's lives better. It's not for making America the best we can be. It's about their narrow self-interest. It's about their narrow vision of what this country should look like. And when none of Kevin McCarthy's appointments for this select committee on economic disparity and fairness and growth refuse to join the committee, is our government completely broken now? And is it what happened on January 6th that has torn us completely apart because of the former guy? Now look, over the next couple of weeks, I want to hear more stories of the people who lived through that horrific day. But more importantly, I want to go after the people who funded it. I want the people who organized, who encouraged, who made it all possible and paid for it. For me, those are the people that we have to go after, not the people who bought into the their lives are less than it should be because, you know, some minority group had an opportunity or because women have an opportunity or whatever their in their twisted little mind is out there. I want the people who duped these folks. I want the people who brought these people along. And it's not just here at home either. It's across the globe. So I'm hoping a lot from this committee. Sadly, as I said yesterday, I don't know that a lot's going to happen, but I'm hopeful. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. There's nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win on the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. That was the day striking railroad workers in Chicago clashed with police in the Battle of the Halsted Street Viaduct. The Great Railroad Strike had reached the nation's railroad hub and began there 3 days earlier. Switchmen from the Michigan Central traveled to freight shops in yards across the city, calling workers out to strike. Soon, lumber shovers, butchers, and industrial workers joined the strike. By the time the battle began, police had already clashed with unarmed strikers twice. Historian Richard Schneveroff describes the scene leading up to the battle. The city was now preparing itself for a full-scale insurrection, even though violent confrontations were rooted in police attacks on non-violent crowds. Previous confrontations centered in the railroad yards. Now, striker actions spilled over into the neighborhood of Pilsen, where they live. Thousands gathered along Halsted Street between 12th and 16th Streets. The police arrived, attempting to disperse the crowd. They chased the strikers south and, as Schneeroff describes, emptied their revolvers into the masses of humanity. The crowd pelted the police with stones in defense and chased them over the viaduct. As word spread of the pitched battle, stockyard workers from nearby Bridgeport walked off the job. They marched along Halsted Street with butcher knives in hand to support the strikers under attack. The crowd on Halsted swelled to more than 10,000 as workers continued to battle police. By evening, 30 workers had been shot dead. Hundreds more were seriously wounded. But the strike continued to spread more fiercely. Streetcar stockmen, stone cutters, gas workers, glass cutters, and others joined the strike. The city was shut down for another week until railroad bosses finally rescinded wage cuts. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
New poll out 9 battleground states across the country. What they found is really extremely strong support for the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or the PRO Act. In fact, overall in the 9 battleground states, 69% were in favor of the PRO Act, just 20% opposed. My state, where I live now in Pennsylvania, number one, 76% of the folks they polled in Pennsylvania in favor of getting the PRO Act passed, followed by Alaska at 72%, Wisconsin 71%, Virginia 70%. Hey, Virginia, how about undoing your no rights at work law? And Ohio at 65%. Overwhelmingly popular. People want to be able to join in foreign unions. People want to be able to bargain with their bosses for better wages, hours, and conditions. Problem is, we've had a broken political system for far too long that many Republicans have figured out how to screw up. And this is why I come back to what we saw on January 6th. The anger that Trump was able to tap into goes right back to the fact that we've allowed unions to get broken up. And here to share some thoughts on how we get this PRO Act passed, how we revive the American dream, how we revive that opportunity, that meritocracy that we were led to believe. I've asked Mark Fluharty to come talk with us. Mark is the executive director of the Central Ohio Labor Council. Mark, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, Rick, I'm glad to be here.
So I'm looking at this poll that just came out. I'll tell you, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that, 76% of the people that they polled here in Pennsylvania think we should have strong labor unions for workers to benefit when companies do well. I'm not surprised at it at all.
Well, Rick, let me just share a quick story about union organizing that I just testified in front of Columbus City Council last night about. So last November, the workers at Habitat for Humanity here in Columbus decided that they wanted to organize a union, right? So Workers United comes to town, they get a campaign going, and Habitat for Humanity does a lot of great work in the community, as we all know. But they're a horrible employer. Their people make $15 an hour, and they wanted to do collective bargaining, have some say-so in their work. Company brings in anti-union lawyer, fire a couple of the union supporters. And here's people scrapping by, making $15 an hour, while the CEO makes $324,000 a year, right? So yeah, we need some change in labor law. Rick, you just pointed out that Virginia, right to work state, right? 1947 is the last year that we have any type of labor law reform. In 1947, we get the Taft-Hartley Act, which, creates right to work and sends a downward spiral in the South in wages and unionizing. If you look at the states that are mostly right to work, they're Southern states. What happened in the North? Good jobs went down to the South, right? Well, now the good jobs that went down to the South are now going down to Mexico, or they're going overseas. So, the right to organize was given to us in 1932. It's what built the middle class. My father, my grandparents were union workers. I grew up in a union household. I've always had great union health care. I've always made good union wages. I was able to retire because I have a union pension. And our young people today are wanting the same thing. Unions are as popular now amongst young people as they've ever been, over 70%.
Right.
Would say they'd join a union if they could.
Yep.
But just my example, with Habitat for Humanity, there's the roadblocks.
No, and we saw that on full display with the Amazon campaign down in Bessemer, Alabama. And I'm glad that got the kind of attention that it deserved, because what Amazon did wasn't unusual in organizing campaigns. They did all of the things that the union busting firms do. They did it all out in front for everyone to see. And I'm glad people saw that, because I think that the more we see how these things happen, the more we see the desperation that employees feel, the fear that they feel, the harassment that they're put through, the more I think things like the PRO Act will remain popular and get even more so popular.
Yeah, absolutely. People are struggling now, and you see it all across the country in the fight for, 15. Well, now it's fight even for like 17 and above. People are struggling. We got people working two or three jobs. We got people that can't afford housing. We've got a hunger problem in this country. And the wealth in this country is not getting down to the people that make it, the workers.
Right. No, we were told, Mark, that, you know, we just give Jeff Bezos all the money. Eventually, it'll trickle down to us. You know, when he shot up into space, something would come trickling down on us. It just never seems to actually happen. The rivers of gold and honey that we were promised, it's yellow, all right, but it ain't gold and honey.
Well, Jeff, you know, I graduated high school in 1981. I'm still waiting on Ronald Reagan's trickle down to get to me. Still haven't seen it yet.
If we just do more of it, I'm told. If we just do a little bit more, we give the rich a little bit more, we cut taxes on corporations a little bit more. Just do it a little bit more, Mark. Eventually the greedy get full. Eventually their pockets are full, and something will then spill out for you and I to fight over.
Well, I'm still waiting on that to happen, Jeff. You know, I don't think that the greedy ever get full, and I don't think they ever think they have their fair share. And I don't think they can ever tell you that, you know, when is enough enough. You know, when you have the Walton family of Walmart, the race to the bottom of Amazon and their workers, you know, we're not getting full. We're not getting a trickle down. What we're getting is people working two or three jobs to make a living.
So let me ask you this.
Go ahead.
The PRO Act, you know, I'm a supporter. I was a supporter of the Employee Free Choice Act. I said that was too weak back during the Obama years. In fact, my wife's going to roll her eyes here in a second. I shook Barack Obama's hand twice. I asked him, are we going to get the Employee Free Choice Act? And both times he said we were going to get something better. We got nothing. I look at the PRO Act and I say, this is good. Lots of steps in the right direction. For me, I just want a full repeal of Taft-Hartley and go back to the original intent of the National Labor Relations Act, which is me being able to join and form a union with my coworkers without interference from the employers. But that's a whole nother thing. This PRO Act, tell me what's in it. Tell me how we get to the point where it gets passed. And do you see a way of going through the regular channels of passing legislation? Or is this a budget reconciliation thing? There's a lot there, well, but I'm going to give you a chance.
You know, the PRO Act and the reform that it brings to the table are long overdue. You know, what the PRO Act does is really levels the playing field for workers to freely join a union without fear of harassment and intimidation from their employer. It opens the door for collective bargaining. A lot of people don't know that, you know, when even if you can join a union, you can hold workers enough together, fight through an anti-union campaign and get the unit certified, that you only have a year to get a first contract.
Right.
If you don't have that year, if you don't get that first contract, you may be starting all over. The PRO Act takes care of that, right? It gives you an avenue to get a first contract. So, you know, this is the biggest labor law reform in, you know, my lifetime. And it's tough. It was tough back in the Employee Free Choice Act. I went to Washington myself to lobby. I was there when Tom Harkin came out and told us, guys, you've done a hell of a job, but guess what? It's not going to happen because we're going to focus on health care. And I do know that we do have a pro-union president now, probably the greatest pro-union president since FDR. And is it going to be easy? No. I've been doing things all year at the labor council here in the labor movement to put pressure on our senators to do the right thing. But here in Ohio, we have Rob Portman, right? So Rob Portman is about as anti-labor as anybody is. And he's pretty much told us all that, you know, raise all the hell you want. I'm not going to change my mind. So, you know, we got to look outside the box and see where we can influence other senators to get to the 60.
Right.
We might be lucky enough. We might be lucky enough to get some things through reconciliation, you know, what'll go through. I'm not really hopeful. And I was having a discussion today with several of the elected officials around town. We're in a ball back and forth type of situation between each president. So here comes, you know, Bill Clinton, and he uses executive orders to change the labor board, do some favorable laws. George Bush comes along and undoes. So here comes Obama. He gets a better board. Here comes Trump along, and he crushes it. So now we have Joe. And what my point is that the worker is the one that's suffering, right?
Yep.
And we all know, I mean, it's proven. CEO pay is over 500% of what the average worker makes in this country. That's what this is causing.
Now, for me, I don't see the whole piece of legislation going through. I have some friends, you know, in labor who are saying, "No, we're gonna force Republicans to vote for it. We're gonna get to the 60 votes. We're gonna get it through." I don't see that possible. There are some things that we can do through budget reconciliation that I think could be helpful. One of those things is increasing fines on employers who break the rules and violate the law, and do things that are outside the bounds. I think that would be helpful. I don't know how helpful. So I'm curious if that was what we would get, because that's the economic part of this. Would that be helpful to you as an organizer?
Well, it most certainly couldn't help, Rick. And let's just use just for quickly immigration and illegal immigration, right? So it's exploited in the country, and you can go to about any meat processing plant, food processing plant around the country. Matter of fact, I just had one down in Mississippi last year. There's no real disincentive not to hire illegal immigrants, right? Because the fine is just ridiculously low. So same thing here. Now, if they're going to make the fine significant enough to get employers' attention, yeah, it most certainly can help. Anything can help. But if I had my wish, you know, I can live with the election system, most certainly. If I could just get the employers to stay out and some type of guarantee for a first contract, those two things could change the working system for men and women in this country.
Now, basically what you're looking at is what you're talking about is what the Employee Free Choice Act had done. There was a time frame for a first contract arbitration. There was triple the penalties for anything. Any worker who was fired, they would have to reimburse them triple. Because as you know it better than anyone. If an employer like Amazon fires someone and that person goes out and gets a job and makes the same amount of money, even if that guy gets his job back, Amazon doesn't have to pay anything because the guy didn't really lose any wages. So there's no disincentive for them not to fire people and put their thumb on it. And also there was the card check part of it. When you get enough cards signed, the unit's recognized. I think those things would be helpful. I would take that at this moment.
Yes, I would most certainly take that. That is definitely a step in the right direction. You know, this is probably the last time, Rick, in our lifetime where the cards are going to line up that we may be able to really get something done.
Yeah.
I've been waiting for this moment for over 30 years, and I'm doing everything I can in my local community, in my city here in Columbus, Ohio, in my state of Ohio, with my elected officials to lobby, to put pressure. I encourage all working people. This benefits everybody, you know, not just union workers. And we all know the higher union density that we have in this country, that raises everybody's wages up. People are more likely to own a home if they're in a union. Minorities are more likely to have a living wage, have health care. God forbid, you know, even talking about retirement. So, you know, a better, higher union density is just good for everybody.
No, I'm right there with you. And look, we're right about the same age. And, you know, I say the same thing. I've worked my entire adult working life to try and give my children and future generations the opportunities that I've had. And I think this is our opportunity to pass something positive along and give them opportunities that we had. And I fear that if we lose this moment, and I hate being the doomsday guy, but I see things getting much worse for workers in this country.
Yeah, Dad. You know, this is, I think, really a make or break point for the American labor movement. You know, we've been just treading water most of my working career over the last 30 years. I've been in union leadership almost that whole time. We've been treading water. You know, we can't keep up with the amount of people that really need to be organized. And just a couple facts. I mean, between 1948 and 1973, right, the New Deal laws get expanded and collective bargaining is enforced. Hourly rate wages rose by more than 90%, all right? But then over the next 40 years, from 73 to 2013, hourly wages just over 9%. You know, that's real numbers. You know, what's happening, and the pandemic showed it to everybody, the rich are just getting richer at our expense.
Yep.
You know, we're making it for them, and we're not sharing in it.
No, you're absolutely right. And in fact, during that time, 73 to 13, what you also found is the wage of the top 1%, our CEO class, went up almost 1,000%. So there's a huge difference in who got what. And it comes back to policy. Policy did this to us. Policy can undo it. And for me, something like the PRO Act would get us in the right direction. So last question I've got for you, how do we get people on board? What do we get? How do we get people to push and call senators and do all that stuff?
Well, I tell you, Rick, here in Ohio, we've been working our tails off to do that very thing. We've had 2 weeks of action, one in April, and matter of fact, just concluded one. And as a matter of fact, Labor Day weekend is going to be another push. So what I would tell everybody, whether you're union or not, is to look at your local labor council. Everybody has one. And, you know, get involved. Call your senator. Call Rob Portman, call the senator in your state, put the pressure on them. It's going to take all of us to do it. It can be done, but we're going to have to be aggressive, and we're going to have to be forceful, and we're going to have to stick together.
I'm right there with you, Mark. Mark, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you. I hope you'll come back and share some more as this continues, something not going to go away anytime soon. Mark Fluharty, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, Rick, thanks a lot. I would love to come back.
Beautiful. Good stuff. For more information, if you want to check out more about the PRO Act, AFL-CIO.org, the website. You can also check out Mark's website, CentralOhioLaborCouncil.org. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1990. That was the day that George H.W. Bush signed into law the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA prohibits employment discrimination of people with disabilities and requires public accommodations to be accessible. The passage of the act was the result of years of grassroots organizing by members of the ADA community and their allies. When President Bush signed the law, he said that if he had to thank everyone who had been involved, we'd never get out of here before sunset. The passage of the act had bipartisan support, but many business leaders worried about the ADA's effect, fearing the costs of accessibility accommodations to their bottom lines. While most business leaders did not oppose the act outright, they did push for amendments and concessions to weaken its impact. The business newspaper, The Wall Street Journal, called the act, quote, the Lawyer's Employment Act, warning that a flood of lawsuits on disability issues would harm businesses. In signing the bill, President Bush addressed business leaders specifically. He said, quote, you've called for new sources of workers. Well, many of our fellow citizens with disabilities are unemployed. They want to work, and they can work. And this is a tremendous pool of people. And remember, this is a tremendous pool of people who will bring to jobs diversity, loyalty, proven low turnover rate, and only one request, the chance to prove themselves. The passage of the ADA paved the way for fundamental changes in America's infrastructure, such as accessibility ramps, spots for wheelchairs on buses and subways, and parking accommodations. This was a major step forward, yet more work remains in order to build a society truly accessible to all. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Over the weekend, the Chinese Communist government, not happy with NBC Universal. Evidently, NBC didn't show the Chinese Communist government approved map of China. They called it an incomplete map. They were very angry. Said that NBC Universal had, slighted the Chinese people, had hurt the dignity and emotions of the Chinese people, is exactly how they put it. They say they urge NBC to recognize the serious nature of this problem and take measures to correct the error. As far as I remember, now look, I was watching some of the Olympics. Didn't Taiwan have a team? So how can you include Taiwan in the Chinese map when Taiwan's actually competing? Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, well, this egregious error and what position NBC was really in. I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it is always great to be with you, and I'm happy to talk about the Olympics, one of my favorite topics.
So NBC hurt the dignity and the emotions of the Chinese people by not including Taiwan in the Chinese map. Why is this a big deal to the Chinese?
Yeah, I think that the Chinese Communist Party in particular is overly sensitive to this because they have a narrative. In their minds, it's the only narrative. And if they cannot persuade people or corporations or governments to adhere to that narrative, they bully, they punish, they threaten. And this is the latest in a string of incidents like this. You know, I one of the airlines, Delta, I think, was chided because of the way in which it referred to Taiwan on a map and in written communication. In the opening ceremonies, broadcasters got chided by the Chinese government for referring to Taiwan and Hong Kong, not as Chinese Taipei or Chinese Hong Kong. And it was very upsetting to them, incredibly overly sensitive to this. It's not in the Olympic spirit, I would say. I know Taiwan has an Olympic team because I saw a couple of weightlifters do really well today. Doing perfectly fine. Yeah.
So, because I don't remember this being a thing in past Olympics. Is this new?
I'm trying to think of a way to put this. It's always been a thing, just kind of both the terminology, but there is also an incredibly increased sensitivity to this. And the Chinese Communist Party and Xi Jinping in particular are really kind of sowing their oats on this. I mean, they feel more powerful than ever, and like they can, they expect others, and again, people, corporations, governments, to adhere to that line, or they're going to be faced with sanction, or bullying, or intimidation, and there could be financial consequences to that as well. So it doesn't put anybody in a particularly great spot who is willing to kind of just say the truth about this or to push the Chinese Communist Party away.
Yeah. Now, the reason I bring this up is it appears to me, and I understand that they've always viewed Taiwan as attached to them, and we've always viewed them as an independent sovereign state. I kind of get that. But this is the first time where they've really made a big deal about it, I think, that I've noticed. And to me, we're seeing them become much more aggressive, much more muscular in foreign policy, which makes me start going, you know, we better start ramping up our own ability to produce things. We better start clawing back some of our production capabilities because they see themselves as, well, the dominant force in the 21st century.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Biden administration early on captured the challenge of China and dealing with its government very completely, which when they said, when we can cooperate, we will. When we must challenge them, we'll do that. And when we need to confront them, if it comes to that, we're going to have to do that. And we're going to have to be ready for that and go into it with clear eyes and determination. But Rick, to your point, it does not make sense, particularly and I'm just going to use clean energy as an example here. If we're trying to scale up a clean energy and energy economy in this country, you need lithium-ion batteries. And lithium-ion batteries, 70% of the world's supply comes from China right now. So that doesn't bode well for the clean energy economy in the United States. We need to make sure that we are scaling it up here in the United States, and that we are also ensuring that our producers don't get swamped by the subsidies and unfair trade practices of Chinese companies and the Chinese government.
Yeah. Now, you guys have put out a video on why the Biden administration must keep the Section 232 trade actions in place, because we're in a stand up for steel moment. Because look, if you don't have the bare resources, the raw resources to create the things that we need, as we're talking about rebuilding our infrastructure, you're going to be dependent on someone else. And well, that didn't go well during the pandemic. So how is this trade action, this Section 232 trade action, going to help save our steel industry and make it strong to compete in the future?
Yeah, so there are 25% tariffs on some imported steel, including steel from China and European countries and Japan and many other places in the world. And they were put into place to ensure that more steel companies didn't go bankrupt. I mean, you know well, Rick, in Pennsylvania, what has happened throughout the 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s and some of the blast furnace closures and other things that were happening again.
Yeah, I grew up in Cleveland. Same thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the issue is that China's steel industry is so big, it produces about 55% of the world's steel, and most of its big companies are owned by the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, that if they decide to distort the market, it impacts steel producers here and around the world. And so we need to make sure that we're producing more of our own steel here at home, that we're giving our workers an opportunity to do that, and that we aren't getting undercut by unfair competition. And I would like to do this 1,000 other different ways than to have 25% tariffs, but that's what we have to have, because there is no better solution at this point in time. It's allowing our steel industry to invest in the future and to stay solvent and hopefully to thrive. And we want to see that continue on into the future. I think that's a good thing.
I'm right there with you. And I look at this, and in your video, you pointed out that, you know, this is a national security issue and an economic security issue.
Right. That's right. Aircraft carriers, constructed from armor plate steel and other kinds of steel. Even we were talking about the clean energy economy, even a solar panel farm, a solar farm, has, thousands of tons of steel in it. And so we're going to depend on this as we head into the future. And we may be in a digital economy in many ways, but the world around us is still built out of things like steel, and we need to make it here at home. And we're not going to be able to do that if our steelmakers, our steel workers are undercut by Chinese competition. And here's the deal, and here's the rub, I guess, is that the Europeans desperately want these tariffs off of them. And I think it's fair to say, for the Biden administration to say to Europe, well, what have you done for us? You know, are you going to stand up to China? Are you going to stop dumping? There are 40 anti-dumping orders in place against European metal right now. And so, you know, we need you to do a better job as well, then we can talk about it. But until then, we got to keep the tariffs in place.
Yeah. I've had people tell me that I'm an isolationist because I call for these kind of protective things. And I say, no, I'm a protectionist. When I leave my house, I lock the door. I'm not an isolationist. I didn't dig a big moat with alligators and a drawbridge, but I do protect things. And this is one of those things. We need the capacity to produce steel. There's no way around that. So we do need to protect what industry we have and help promote and make it stronger. And to me, this just makes sense.
Some wise man once said, you know, you're not going to win the next world war by flipping burgers at McDonald's or clicking a button for Amazon. It takes metal and lots of it. It takes know-how, too. But that's why you want to have that capability to produce steel in the United States. And not only that, as you mentioned, good paying jobs, middle class jobs, particularly for workers who don't have a 4-year college degree, and helps to meet our climate goals. Put simply, when we produce steel here, there's less carbon output than we're seeing in steel from China and many other places around the world as well. So we're doing the environment and greenhouse gas emissions a favor as well by keeping that production here in the United States.
Yeah, we need the capacity to make our own steel, but also the sophisticated stuff. I mean, you know, I saw a story today that said, you know, there's a single company in Taiwan that makes almost all of the world's most sophisticated chips, the ones that are going to run our smart things and communicate with everything. We don't make hardly any of those. And how are you going to compete in the 21st century digital economy when you can't create the infrastructure that it takes to do that?
Yeah, having one company or place or human that has a particular set of know-how or kind of a monopoly on production is not good for anybody. And so we definitely need to see that diversification. The United States makes about 12% of the world's semiconductors right now. We consume a lot more than that, but we produce about 12%. We used to produce about 30% of the world's semiconductors. And so, you know, the Senate, the USICA bill, Innovation Competition Act, it was passed. You know, I'd like to see that move forward in the House of Representatives to boost up our semiconductor funding. And I think this is important. And again, I'm going to go back to China here. We know that 40% of the planned semiconductor capacity expansions are in China. And so we don't want to be more dependent on China. We want to be less dependent on China. And so that's why we need an industrial policy that's going to get those semiconductors and other critical products built here at home so that we can have that sense of security. I'm with you. We're not isolationists. We want to trade with the rest of the world. We'll still be importing semiconductors even after that. But we got to do better about making some of that stuff here, Rick.
Yeah, I've been saying for years, you know, there's evidently, and again, this is way above my pay grade, but evidently there's a chip that goes in, that makes our smart bombs smart, that one of the only places in the world that they make it is in China. And I'm going, explain to me why we want to have chips that go into, that make our smart bombs smart, made by an adversary. Look, I don't know an awful lot about chips, but I don't know. Can you put other codes in there? Can you figure out how to get those things to turn around? I don't know. I don't feel safe having an adversary. You're doing things at that level. Just my paranoia.
Right. Well, believe me, the Defense Department, security, intelligence agencies have gamed out those scenarios, and it is not a far-fetched fiction to think that could happen. It is quite possible to see that. I mean, obviously, there's a different level of sophistication when you're talking about military equipment. But it's super easy to hack into autonomous vehicles. And so you're absolutely right. We need to be darn sure that the electronic equipment, that those chips, that everything is secure, that we can depend on it, and that we don't have to worry about it being hacked or manipulated, or just put simply some supply coming from China that they could just, you know, turn off the spigot at any time if they're unhappy about the way that we're coloring the map.
Yep. Yeah. No, we saw that, you know, with masks and protective gear during the pandemic. And I'm like, did we learn nothing from this? And this is why I keep coming back to, I remember going into Trenton, New Jersey, where there's this great bridge that said, you know, Trenton makes the world takes. That used to be the reality of this country. We were the productive country for decades. Now we've lost that manufacturing prowess. It's time to get that back because, look, if we're going to rebuild our infrastructure, if we're going to move to the 21st century, we have to have the capacity to do it. Because, look, we're talking about a big infrastructure bill. Is it going to help us rebuild our economy and our country or the Chinese?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's important. And infrastructure is one of those pieces, along with the industrial policy that I talked about earlier. And we talked about trade. But having that investment in infrastructure, broadband, electrical grid, physical infrastructure, is going to be key. It's going to be key for jobs, key for competitiveness, all of that. And, you know, the Senate, God bless the bipartisan group trying to reach an agreement. I hope they do. I hope they get this across the finish line. But we can't wait forever. We have to get this done. We have a window of opportunity. And this is going to help bridges, broadband, water, electrical grid in every state, red and blue. So it's time to move this forward. I'm hopeful that we can do this with broad bipartisan support because Lord knows voters think it's a great idea across the board. But we have to get Washington to act, and we have to do it soon. Yeah. And so I certainly understand the frustration that many House Democrats and others have with this bipartisan process. It's got to come to a close. But we got to get a deal made here. We got to move on. We got to get something passed.
No, I'm right there with you. And if you can't get it, you got to push it through budget reconciliation, because we need to get something done. If nothing happens this time around, and this is one of those things where red, blue doesn't matter. If we get nothing done again, because we just lived through 4 years of nothing getting done, the Chinese get that much further ahead in this race. Because I don't know if you're seeing the stories that I'm seeing. They're investing heavily in their infrastructure. Yeah. They're investing heavily in the new technologies of the next generation, while we're mired in this infighting over the former guy.
Yeah, we're so far behind with all of that, just because we've starved our public works. We really have. And we're resting on the laurels of the interstate highway system and the New Deal. They were great, but they're not getting any younger. And so it's time for that next generation of great things. Other nations have leaped ahead of us with that. Not only China, but other nations as well. It's time that we reclaim that mantelpiece of being global leaders as we look at this next generation of infrastructure, which is a smart grid, which is 5G and broadband, which is this interconnectivity. We have to do a better job of this. And it starts with a major federal investment that's going to look out for workers here in the United States. We got to get it done, Rick. We're committed to doing that.
No, and that's one of those things. Call your senators, call your House members early, call them often. We need to be competitive around the world. And look, if there's one thing that I think can pull us all together, it's that we need to be competitive with China because,
yeah,
they're going to eat our lunch. I hope folks will check out the website, Alliancefor AmericanManufacturing.org. We'll get links out on social media how folks can check that out. But, Scott, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff, good information. Look forward to talking to you again.
Likewise, Rick. Keep up the fight. Thanks for having me on.
Anytime. Good stuff. Our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1775. That was the day the United States Post Office was created in Philadelphia under Benjamin Franklin. Franklin was a member of the Second Continental Congress. Among many other distinctions, Ben Franklin was named the nation's first Postmaster General. Franklin received a salary of $1,000, with an additional $340 for a secretary and comptroller. His responsibilities spanned all post offices from Massachusetts to Georgia, and he had the authority to hire additional postmasters as necessary. Previously, in 1753, Benjamin Franklin helped lead the postal service in the colonies. He made numerous improvements in the mail system, including setting up new, more efficient routes. He had also been able to cut delivery time in half between Philadelphia and New York by having weekly mail wagons travel both day and night via relay teams. In 1774, the British fired Franklin from his postmaster job because of his revolutionary activities. There have been postal unions dating back to the 19th century. Those early unions had essentially no bargaining rights. They existed largely as lobbying organizations that otherwise would have no say about their working conditions. Wage increases depended on the whim of Congress. On March 18, 1970, thousands of New York City postal workers walked off the job in protest. They were joined in the streets by 200,000 others in 30 major cities. Mail service ground to a halt, and the plight of postal workers was brought to the public's attention. The strike was soon settled, with Congress approving a 6% wage increase. The strike served as an impetus for the enactment of the Postal Reorganization Act of 1970, which granted unions the right to negotiate with management over their wages, benefits, and working conditions.